Chapter 50. 20,000 meters above the Antarctic Peninsula, the Delta Wing reconnaissance plane slipped through the rarefied air at 3,200 kilometers per hour. She was designed to fly twice that altitude at twice the speed, but her pilot held her at 40% throttle to conserve fuel and give the cameras a chance to sharpen Earth images under the slower speed. Unlike her ancestor, the SR-71 Blackbird, whose natural titanium wings and fuselage wore the color of deep indigo, the stealth technology of the more advanced SR-90 created an incredibly tough, lightweight plastic skin that was tinted gray-white. Named the Casper, after the cartoon ghost, she was almost as impossible to detect by eye as she was by radar. Her 5 cameras could capture half the length of the United States in 1 hour with only one pass. Her photographic package filmed in black and white, color, infrared, three-dimensional, and a few imagery techniques that were highly classified and totally unknown to commercial photographers. Lieutenant Colonel James Slade had little to do. It was a long, boring reconnaissance from his base in California's Mojave Desert. The only time he took manual control in flight was during refueling operations. The Casper's engines had a heavy thirst. She had to be refueled twice on each leg of the flight by aerial tankers. Slade examined the instruments with a critical eye. The Casper was a new plane, and she had yet to reveal all her bugs. Thankful to find normal readings across the board, he sighed and pulled a miniature electronic game from a pocket of his flight suit. He began pressing the buttons below a small viewing window, trying to get a tiny diver past a giant octopus to reach a treasure chest. After a few minutes, he tired of the game and gazed ahead and down at the frozen isolation that was Antarctica. Far below, the curved, beckoning finger of the northern peninsula and its adjoining islands sparkled under a diamond-clear sky. The ice and rock and sea created a beautiful vastness, awesome to the eye, intimidating to the soul. The sight may have looked appealing from 20 kilometers overhead, but Slade knew better. He'd once flown supplies to a scientific station at the South Pole and quickly learned the beauty and the hostility in the permanent domain of cold went hand in hand. He well remembered the chilling temperatures. He didn't believe it possible to spit and see the saliva freeze before it hit the ground. And he never forgot the ferocious winds that scourge the coldest of all continents. The 160-kilometer gusts were unimaginable until he experienced them for the first time. Slade could never fathom why some men were so attracted to that frozen hell. He had a facetious urge to call a travel agent after he returned to base and inquire about reservations at a good resort hotel close to the polar center. Suddenly, a female voice spoke over one of the 3 cockpit speakers.
"Attention, please. You are about to cross the outer limit of your flight path where 70 degrees longitude and 70 degrees latitude intersect. Disengage autopilot and come around 180 degrees beginning now. The new heading for your return is programmed into the computer. Please enter the appropriate code. Have a good trip home."
Slade followed the instructions and made a lazy turn. As soon as the computer locked on the return heading, he went back on autopilot and shifted to a more comfortable position in his cramped seat. Like so many other men who flew reconnaissance missions, he fantasized about the face and body that went with the disembodied voice. Rumor had it she weighed 300 pounds, was 60 years old, and a grandmother 12 times. No pilot with a sound imagination could believe such a myth-shattering thought. She had to look like Sigourney Weaver. Maybe it was Sigourney Weaver. He decided to explore the tantalizing possibility on his return home. That delicate problem solved, Slade rechecked his instrument panel and then relaxed while the icebound land drifted away behind his tail. Over the sea again, he returned to his little electronic treasure game. He saw little purpose in continuing to watch the world roll by, especially since Tierra del Fuego was covered by thick blankets of charcoal clouds. He'd studied enough geography to know it was a wretched land of constant wind, rain, and snow. Slade was almost thankful he couldn't see the monotonous landscape. He left it to Casper's infrared camera to penetrate the dark overcast and record the desolate dead end of the continent. Captain Collins stared into Amar's mask and had to force himself not to avert his gaze. There was something evil, something inhuman in the eyes of the urbane leader of the hijackers. Collins could sense a chilling unconcern for mere human life about the man. "I demand to know when you're going to release my ship," said Collins in a precise tone. Amar set a cup of tea on a saucer, patted his lips with a table napkin, and looked at Collins detachedly. "Can I offer you some tea?" "Not unless you offer it to my passengers and crew as well," Collins replied calmly. He stood erectly in his summer white uniform, bitterly cold and shivering. "The very answer I expected." Amar turned the empty cup upside down and leaned back. "You'll be happy to know my men and I expect to leave sometime tomorrow evening. If you give me your word, there will be no foolish attempt to retake the ship or escape to the nearby shore before we depart. No one will be harmed, and you can resume command. I'd rather you heat the ship and feed everyone now. We're desperately short of warm clothing and blankets to ward off the cold. No one has eaten in days. The pipes have frozen, blocking all water. And I don't have to mention the sanitation problems."
"Suffering is good for the soul," Amar said philosophically.
Collins glared at him.
"What utter tripe."
Amar shrugged wearily.
"If you say so."
"Good God, man, there are people sick and dying on this ship. I doubt seriously whether any of your crew and passengers will die of exposure or from starvation before my departure," said Amar curtly. "They'll simply have to survive some discomfort for the next 30 hours or so until you can restart the engines and heat the ship. That may be too late for any of us if the wall of the glacier breaks off."
"It looks solid enough."
"You don't realize the danger. A massive ice slab may fall any moment. The weight could smash the Lady Flamborough like a 10-story building collapsing on an automobile. You must move the ship."
"A risk I cannot avoid. The ice film on the plastic would melt, giving away our location, and satellite infrared cameras could detect our radiated heat."
Collins's face was lined with helpless rage. "You're either a fool or you're insane. What good has any of this proven? What profit will you get out of it? Are we being held for ransom or as hostages in return for freeing your fellow terrorists behind bars somewhere? If you're simply walking off and leaving us, I fail to see the purpose."
"You have an irritating degree of curiosity, Captain, but a dedication of purpose after my own heart. You will learn the reasons behind our capture of your ship soon enough."
Amar rose and nodded at the guard who stood behind Collins. "Return the captain to confinement." Collins refused to move. "Why can't you provide hot tea, coffee, soup, anything that will alleviate the suffering?"
Amar did not bother to turn as he walked from the dining salon.
"Goodbye, Captain. We won't meet again." Amar went directly to the communications room. Eben was standing, watching a teletype hum out the latest wire service news. His electronics man was seated at the radio, listening to an incoming transmission while a voice recorder copied it on paper. The radio and teletype were powered by a portable generator. Eben turned at Amar's approach, gave a brief nod in recognition, and tore a long sheet of paper from the teletype.
"The international news media are still reporting the Lady Flamborough is lost," he reported. "Salvage ships are only now arriving off Uruguay to conduct an underwater search. My compliments, Suleiman. You fooled the world. We'll be safely back in Cairo before the West learns the truth."
"What news of Egypt?" asked Amar.
"Nothing worth celebrating yet. Hassan's cabinet ministers still control the government. They stubbornly hold on to power. They've played it smart by not sending in security forces to smash the demonstrations. The only bloodshed was caused by our fundamentalist brothers who mistakenly blew up a busload of Algerian firemen attending a convention in Cairo. It was thought the bus was part of a government police convoy. The Cairo News Network is claiming Ahmad Yazid's movement is a front for Iranian fanatics. Many supporters are wavering in their loyalty, and there has been no mass demand for Hassan's cabinet to dissolve the government."
"That idiot Khaled Fazi was behind the bus explosion," snarled Amar.
"The military, where do the armed forces stand?"
"Defense Minister Abu Hamid will not commit himself until he views the bodies of President Hassan and Hala Kamil to confirm their deaths."
"So Yazid has yet to make a triumphal takeover."
Ibn nodded, and his expression turned grave.
"There is another news item. Yazid has announced that the cruise ship crew and passengers still live.
and he will personally negotiate with the terrorists and arrange for the release of everyone. He has gone so far as to offer his life in return for Senator George Pitt to impress the Americans. A numbing, paralyzing rage swelled within Amar, sharpening his senses and opening his thoughts like envelopes inside his mind. After a few moments, he looked at Ibn.
"By Allah, the Judas goat has led us to slaughter," he said incredulously. "Yazid has sold out the mission."
Ibn nodded in agreement.
"Yazid has used and betrayed you. That explains why he stalled off ordering me to kill Hassan, Camille, and the rest. He wanted them unharmed until Machado and his scum could remove you and me and our people."
"What do Yazid and Topiltzin gain by keeping the hostages alive?" asked Ibn.
"By playing the saviors of two presidents, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and an important United States politician, Yazid and Topiltzin will gain the admiration of international leaders. They automatically become stronger while their opponents lose ground. They are then free to assume the reins of their governments in peaceful takeovers, widening their power base and increasing their benevolent images in the eyes of the world."
Ibn bent his head in resignation.
"So we've been thrown to the vultures." Amar nodded. "Yazid meant for us to die from the beginning, to guarantee our silence on this and other missions we've performed for him.
What of Captain Machado and his Mexican crew? What happens to them after they've eliminated us?"
"Topiltzin would see to it they vanished after their return to Mexico."
"They would have to escape the ship and island first."
"Yes," Amar replied thoughtfully.
He paced the communications room angrily.
"It seems I badly underestimated Yazid's cunning. I was smug in thinking Machado was impotent because he knew nothing of our arrangements for escaping to a safe airfield in Argentina. But thanks to Yazid, our Mexican comrade has implemented his own departure plans."
"Then why hasn't he murdered us by now?"
"Because Yazid and Topiltzin won't give him the order until they're ready to act out their sham negotiations for the hostage release."
Suddenly, Amar turned and gripped the shoulder of the radio man, who quickly removed his headphones.
"Have you received any unusual messages directed to the ship?"
The Egyptian communications expert looked curious.
"Strange you should ask. Our Latin friends have been in and out of here every 10 minutes asking the same question. I thought they must be stupid. Any acknowledgement to a direct transmission would be intercepted by American European intelligence listening facilities. They'd fix our position within seconds."
"So you've intercepted nothing suspicious?"
The Arab communications man shook his head.
"Even if I did, any message would certainly be in code."
"Shut down the equipment. Make the Mexicans think you're still listening for something. Whenever they ask about an incoming message, play dumb and keep saying you've heard nothing."
Ibn stared at Amar expectantly.
"My instructions, Suleiman?"
"Keep a sharp watch on Machado's crew. Get them off balance by acting friendly. Open the lounge bar and invite them to drink. Give the worst guard duty to our men so the Latins can relax. This will lower their defenses."
"Shall we kill them before they kill us?"
"No," said Amar, a flicker of sadistic pleasure in his eyes. "We'll leave that job to the glacier."